The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McCrae. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to have a very extended interview with Professor Kelly Drew from the University of Alaska. And that is because she's researching something that is absolutely fascinating to me. And that is hibernation, not just of animals, but also the potential to hibernate human beings for medical and space exploration reasons. It is not as unbelievable as you think. So if you want to get in contact with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're at @NewstalkScience, or you can text us for 30 cents 53106, and we get to all of those comments in an extended version of the podcast. Just search for Future Proof in the Newstalk app or wherever you find your podcasts. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. As we always do, we've got Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and double Dr. Lara Dungan to go through them. You're both very welcome. Our first story. To do with SpaceX, there's been two big stories this week of SpaceX, Shane, and both of them are pretty considerable. There was a crash, a test of a rocket, but that happens regularly enough with SpaceX, in fairness to them. They don't shy away from a good old explosion. But also, there has been this remarkable announcement that a billionaire has bought flights on the first civilian trip into space.
Yeah, so let's start with the crash. And this is the second full test flight of a thankfully remotely operated bullet-shaped vessel called Starship, and it met a fiery end on Tuesday as it crashed into the Texan surface. This stainless steel rocket, what they wanted it to do was to take off, reach an altitude of 10 kilometers, then turn on its side and land. Now, for a rocket to do that is remarkable, for it to land and be reusable. And so everything went well. It reached its height, and then the 50 meter long Starship flipped onto its side and began its descent. However, it didn't straighten up in time for its landing, and that, well, you can imagine what happened. And I love the quote from the launch commander, John Innsbrucker. He said, "Yeah, we have to work on that landing a little bit." And he reminded them that this is a test flight, and I guess it is still rocket science, which is pretty difficult. So they have another Starship. They're ready to go for another test flight. And this is all part of Elon Musk's ongoing mission to carry people in private rockets to Mars and to the moon. And they are very, very confident that they'll have the first all-civilian flight next year. And that, as you said, is associated with a billionaire US businessman who will finance the flight and will pilot it himself on this multi-day mission.
What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, exactly. You know, U.S. Billionaires and businessmen have not done any harm in the last couple of years, right? So, like, yeah, exactly. What can go wrong? I'd love to spend an hour sitting with somebody like that and just hearing what goes through their head. Like, what's their world like? That their goal is to fund probably a pretty expensive rocket trip into space, and to have the audacity, the daring, the wherewithal to pilot that themselves. It, like, would you take a seat on that, trip?
Doesn't it perfectly match the sense of confidence and self-belief that billionaires must have to keep going with their ideas and build an empire that makes billions of euros? Like, there is a positive character trait in there somewhere. It's incredible self-belief. But obviously, I mean, being a pilot, he's going to go through a bunch of training to do this. But it's really remarkable, because this is a proper rocket launch piloted by a private citizen who has flown planes. And in it, there's going to be somebody who wins a lottery by being a customer of his business. Like, it's so far out there from what we usually associate with, you know, civil service launches, NASA, European Space Agency, so on.
Yeah, so let's see what happens. You know, the linking to his business makes me a little bit like, you know, eyebrow raised. Yeah. Is this a fantastic marketing opportunity? Also, just because he's really good at making money doesn't necessarily mean he's very, very good at flying spaceships. So, yeah, let's see how this goes. But you never know. It takes people who do crazy things to break through every so often.
Indeed. Lara, our second story has to do with diet. And I suppose in some ways it's not surprising, but it's not something that we definitively knew before.
Absolutely. So this is new research that's come out of the University of California, Riverside. It was published in the Journal of Experimental Biology. But I suppose the most important thing and caveat I'd like to say beforehand is that this is a study done in mice. And we love in science to do a study in mice and then extrapolate that towards humans without doing anything further. So I'm only saying this now because this is done in baby mice, not baby humans.
Do you know what? The headline I saw did not mention mice.
Exactly. And isn't that the thing? You almost have to get to the fifth paragraph of any story before you realize this is not done in humans.
I really try and avoid these ones. Go on then.
It doesn't make it anything less than legitimate. It's still a very well done research study. But what they did was they took groups of baby mice, four different groups. In one of them, they fed what we would call a standard mouse diet. In one of the groups, they fed them a sort of a Western diet, so high in sugar and high in fats. In the other two groups, they gave them a standard diet and one did lots of exercise and one didn't. So that's the four general groups. And what they did was then after 3 weeks, they left them until they were 14 weeks old. And they say this would be the equivalent of 6 human years extra. So from being a child, you add on 6 years. So I suppose someone in their 20s, essentially. And then they looked at their poop. And what they did was they analyzed it to see whether their microbiome had changed. And they found very interestingly that in the animals that had had a poor diet, essentially, so the high fat, high sugar, their microbiome and the different amounts of bacteria in it had quite significantly reduced, especially one type of bacteria called Muribaculum intestinale. Which they believe is something to do with carbohydrate metabolism and might influence the amount of energy available to a host. They're doing a lot more research on this, but it's interesting to see that this had a lasting effect. So the baby mice had been on a normal diet for the equivalent of 6 human years, and the effects were still there. And interestingly, the ones who had more exercise and then went back to their normal amount also had better biodiversity in their gut and more of this particular bacteria. So overall, it's saying that we are what we eat, not only now, but what we had as a child.
I'd read the headline in the first paragraph and I said, yeah, OK, that sounds pretty good. And I'm really frustrated now because I didn't have time to read the whole thing. And I said, Lara's going to do a great job of explaining this to me. This is a real issue, the extrapolating to human conditions, experiments that we do on mice. Because they don't always, I mean, obviously they don't always translate. But is it a fair thing to say that if we see this in mice, we might see it in humans?
I tell you what, just to clarify, this is not something the researchers have done wrong. They're doing a fantastic job. This is a big problem with media, and it's a problem with print media and often, you know, radio and other media. But like, I did 4 years of research in mice, and I didn't do it because I wanted to look at multiple sclerosis in mice. So yes, nobody would do these things and nobody would put animals through research unless they believed that there was very good extrapolation. But you can't assume it. I mean, I loved the phrase of, oh, a 14-week-old mouse. Oh, well, that's the equivalent of 6 years in humans. And I'm like, that's like saying, you know, every dog year is 7 human. These things just, you know, it's not the equivalent in that sense. But yes, animal research has a huge place and we definitely wouldn't do it if it didn't.
Right. Shane, our third story has to do with a really lovely project to do with music and space.
Yeah, it's about beaming the songs of mice into space, Jonathan. No, it's not. This one is about humans. So in the Californian Cascade Mountains, there are 42 radio telescopes, and they're part of the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI, Institute. And since 1984, they have been looking for signals of intelligent life out in outer space. And they've only managed to see a tiny fraction of the sky. But now it's kind of, it's turning things in reverse. It's going to beam what it's looking for out into space. So it's going to basically generate an Earth-like signal and put that out into space. So if there's anyone else out there who has their own SETI and is looking for intelligent life, they'll see ours. And they're doing it with an artist in residence that they have in SETI, a guy called Felipe Perez Santiago. And he's an artist, and he's working on something called the Earthling Project. So he's going to upload a 30-second snippet of as many human voices singing as he can collect. And I'm going to do this myself.
To
I'm going
to me, the Willowman come. It sounds totally like that project, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So you can submit, Jonathan, your 30-second singing through an app, and he'll put them all together into a composition. And it's just going to be a wall of sound, right? Of human singing. And it's going to be beamed into space this summer, along with the entire contents of Wikipedia and the Rosetta contents, which is a sample of 1,500 human languages.
You know what? I've been broadcasting for, this is going to sound stupid, I've been broadcasting for 11 years. I've done a few things in my life that I've seen Wikipedia pages and I go, I don't have a Wikipedia page, and now the whole of Wikipedia is going to be uploaded to another star system, and I'm not going to be on it. Like, what do I need to do to get on Wikipedia, Shane? This seems like I'm very self-centered, but this is something that keeps me up at night.
Well, I guess it probably won't help to tell you two things. Firstly, I'm sure that the papers that Lara and I have published are on Wikipedia, so we're going, which is great. And also, it's kind of not about you, Jonathan, so...
It is about all humans, and therefore, it is also about me.
Well, you do get the privilege of broadcasting a weekly radio program, and I guess some part of that signal has gone out into space. It might be quite a weak signal, but it's going, you know, so you are out there in the ether, Jonathan. So you get on to the Wikipedia people and maybe get some anonymous friend.
I'm not interested. This is a bit. I'm not interested in being Wikipedia. Let me leave a pause there. All right, let's just wrap this up. Lara, our final story has to do with marmosets.
Absolutely. This is a really lovely study. Lovely because it's really nice science, but also because it's about adorable little monkeys. So marmosets are monkeys found in northeastern Brazil. They're very, very small. They weigh about 250 grams, which is around about a quarter of the weight of a bag of sugar. And they have those fluffy white ears that make them almost look like Albert Einstein. But they also have very interesting social setups. There's around about 15, 16 monkeys in any one group, but only between one and two pairs of them actually breed. Everyone else just pitches in. So sisters, brothers, aunties, cousins, they all pitch in and help to raise the babies, but they don't have their own.
What?
Which is really, really, exactly. It's a really complex setup. And it begs a lot of questions as to why they do that, but also how monkeys pick the people they want in their group, the marmosets that they want in their group as opposed to people. So they did this research from the University of Zurich, and it's really lovely. What they did was they recorded conversations in the wild. So one conversation they recorded was a kind, older marmoset being nice to a baby marmoset looking for food. They also recorded an angry older marmoset who didn't want to help the baby. So then what they did was they put the marmoset in a room and they had him listen to these conversations. And the first thing they did was to find out whether or not he's listening at all. So to do that, they played a separate little sound clip of a marmoset not talking to anyone, just chattering away to himself. And when they analysed the marmoset, they saw that he was only interested in the conversation, the one in between two monkeys, not the one on its own. And they did this by looking at the temperature of his nose. So they put a little infrared camera on his nose and they checked to see if the temperature dropped, which meant that he was interested, he was listening. And he was, but only when it was a conversation. He didn't care about the person chatting to himself.
Why would it just be the nose?
I would suspect, and honestly, I'm not 100% sure, but I would suspect it would be that blood would be rushing to other parts of the body, especially the brain, because he was interested. And therefore, the blood in the more vascular parts, for instance, the nose, would lessen and the temperature should drop. But otherwise, he's covered in fur, so they can't look at any of the other adorable little marmoset parts. The nose is the only bit they could access.
Right.
So then they took him and they put him in a room with a mirror and a few toys. Marmosets have no idea that that's themselves in the mirror. So then they replay the clips, the one clip of the nice motherly marmoset being kind to the baby, the other clip of the angry marmoset who doesn't want to give the baby food. And they try to see what this little marmoset does. And what he does is, when he hears the nice conversation, he's listening in and he's overhearing, and he wants to be friends with this person. So he goes up to the mirror, which he thinks is the other marmoset, and he tries to interact. When he hears the conversations of the angry, the uncaring adult, he doesn't want to have anything to do with them. So it's really interesting. It indicates that they are listening in on other conversations. They're assessing the kind of marmosets they want in their group, the ones they want to help raise their children and be pals. And it indicates a really, really advanced social structure.
Fascinating. Dr. Lara Dungan and Dr. Shane Bergen, thanks as always. Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. Now, even when we're not under strict lockdown, winter can be a tough time for people. And while January might be behind us, the wintry conditions look to remain for a while still. So why don't we all just close up shop, crawl into bed and hibernate until spring, maybe summer? No, seriously, why can't we do this? Professor Kelly Drew is director of the Center of Transformative Research in Metabolism Institute of Arctic Biology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She joins me now. Hi, Kelly, how are you?
Hello, I'm very well and happy to be here.
Let's start off, as I always do in these programs, with the basics. What is hibernation and what sort of animals do it?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, through all this pandemic, it would be nice if we could have all just hibernated. In fact, I saw a slogan, you know, hibernate for the world. So those animals who have evolved to do that spontaneously did so in times when there were was a limitation to resources. So food, primarily, but also water. And they, over evolution, express this deep state of suspended animation, some people like to call it, that really is an extension of sleep. And from what we're learning, it is an increased sensitivity to the temperature, the thermostat reset that is associated with sleep. So even humans, when they sleep, they lower their body temperature, but they only lower it just a little bit. And then what happens in hibernation is that they get that thermostat gets really sensitive to the signal that's coming to it, so that a little bit of signal, or we don't really understand exactly what's happening, but in the winter season for the animals that I study, that thermostat gets turned way down. So then as they enter sleep, their body naturally cools, and because there's no thermostat to kick it back up, they can get all the way down to near freezing, and before their body starts to use energy to warm up. So they save energy that way.
Back up a bit, because when we think of hibernation, we think of, you know, squirrels, bears, other mammals. Is it just mammals that hibernate, or do you see it across the animal kingdom?
Oh, you see it across the animal kingdom in a variety of different branches of the evolutionary tree. So, you know, birds and bats and, you know, all kinds of mammals, including some species of primate.
Bees and wasps as well, right?
Bees and wasps are another story. So it would be, you know, the ones that we're talking about, the bees and the wasps and the insects don't hibernate, but they have unique aspects of what's called freeze tolerance. And so they can even freeze solid. We've got some beetles here in Alaska that can survive minus 80. And so they just freeze up and they're able to come back.
And the tree frog, right? The tree frog can freeze to become pretty much an ice cube.
Yeah, completely an ice cube, you know, except for the insides of its cell. So it's a slightly different story.
Yeah, it's a different process. It's sort of like an antifreeze thing going on.
It's an antifreeze thing, exactly.
So when we're talking about hibernating animals, specifically mammals, I didn't realize primates did it. And that's, you know, they're very close to us from a genetic point of view. But you said it's a temperature thing. So with humans, when we sleep, our temperature drops a little bit. But in a bear or a squirrel, what sort of temperature changes are we talking about?
Well, so in a squirrel, they turn their thermostat down all the way down to about zero.
Wow.
0 Celsius. Yeah.
So their core temperature is almost freezing.
Not only almost, but the Arctic ground squirrel is famous for being able to supercool down to minus 3. And yeah, so how they don't freeze is a whole nother story. It's a lack of a nucleating factor. So they somehow lose that from their blood so that there's nothing to form a crystal around. And if you provide, if you provide something that they can form this crystal around, then they will freeze from that point. So they're super cooled in that way. And so these are mammals. These are the Arctic ground squirrels that we work with.
Okay. And so bears,
and they don't lower their thermostat nearly as much. The bears lower their thermostat to about 30 C. And so bears from 37, about where we are.
Wait, so a Canadian or American grizzly bear might hibernate for 6, possibly up to 8 months, and only drop their core temperature a small amount? How do they stop from using the energy that is so precious during that hibernation time?
Well, part of it is that the bear is so well insulated.
Right.
So they're large, they have a ton of fat, they have a ton of fur, they're just big animals. They still, you know, all these hibernators, they roll up into a ball. So they use everything they can to conserve heat while at the same time lowering the thermostat to save energy. And so it's just the degree that that thermostat goes down is really what distinguishes the small animals from the big animals.
And we don't know what triggers this hibernation in animals. Obviously the temperature outside is key, but is it not just that?
Actually, temperature is not a trigger. So there's there's two kinds of hibernators. We call them obligate, where they're absolutely obligated to hibernate according to the season, and that would be the Arctic ground squirrel, and bears are like that too. And then we have the facultative hibernators, like a hamster, that still needs kind of a seasonal cue, which is a short day. So as the days get shorter, their gonads regress. That's the very first key thing. And then with a lack of food, it can kind of inspire them, encourage them to enter this hibernation state. So that's a facultative that is, you know, theoretically considered to be more inducible through environmental cues.
Right.
But the Arctic ground squirrel and bears are these obligate hibernators. And so for example, the Arctic ground squirrel, we can take from the field and bring them into the lab, put them on completely same day length and same temperature, and they will still hibernate according to the seasonal rhythm. So they have,
this is like an extended circadian rhythm?
Yeah. So it's a rhythm like a circadian. We call it a circannual rhythm.
Right.
And what regulates that, nobody really knows. We know that it entrains to a 12-month year with the changing daylight. So if you put them on constant light, they'll start to free run and show this pattern with a period of about 8 months,
not
12 months. So it'll get shorter.
That's insane.
I know.
So we think of the circadian rhythm as being, you know, daylight and sunrise, sunset, and so on. The idea that this is built into the genes, presumably, of these squirrels, and they can tell what season it is over a year. That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So you said it's temperature. Is there anything else going on you said it's like sleep, and I know different brain waves happen when we sleep, but there's still activity. What happens in these animals, before we start talking about humans, what happens in these animals' brains or their bloodstream? What happens to their organs when they hibernate?
Well, so that is, it's really interesting. Sleep is not the trigger, temperature is not the trigger, but it definitely contributes to the phenomenon. So like the ground squirrel, because their thermostat gets turned down so much, as they enter sleep, they allow their bodies to cool. And as they cool, that temperature now contributes to sort of the more metabolic suppression and affects the brain waves. So they all animals sleep as they enter hibernation. They have to sleep. It's a slow wave sleep. And then that extends into what we call torpor. When torpor is extended, prolonged torpor, now we call it hibernation. So as they sleep, the thermostat is turned down, they get cold. That cold is sort of a feedback loop to where in the ground squirrel, by the time they're down to, you know, 0 degrees or 2 degrees core body temperature, their brain waves are flat. There is no brain wave. If you were to look at them, you'd think they were dead. You'd think, you know, at least comatose.
And presumably no heartbeat either. The heartbeat of a squirrel is normally thump, 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 thump.
Right. It does. The heart does continue to beat.
At the same speed or much slower?
No, it goes from about 200 beats per minute down to about 5 beats per minute.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
Right. And the amplitude gets really slow. So if you put your finger on their chest, you cannot feel it.
Right.
You have to have a transmitter in them to pick up a heart rate, an ECG. But so the bears, though, their sleep doesn't go flatline. You know, their EEG when they sleep doesn't go flatline. They still show signs of sleep. As a matter of fact, we have an investigator here in the center that has a huge data set of 10 bears sleeping throughout hibernation and is just now getting to the point of being able to analyze that. And so then we'll understand more about this, that we call it high temperature torpor in a bear compared to low temperature torpor, and to see what that does to sleep, kind of independent from this very low temperature.
What about the hormones, the flow of hormones within the body during hibernation? You know, we associate cortisol with stress and activity. We associate other hormones with relaxation. Does the flow of hormones change dramatically in advance of a hibernation?
So we don't haven't done comprehensive studies on all the hormones. It's interesting that cortisol, the sign of stress, is low during hibernation. So everything we know about hibernation is kind of a state of nirvana. Mm. There's no stress involved with it.
It's sounds fantastic.
Everything is good, you know. But what we do see with a seasonal component is one are changes in the thyroid hormone system, which is interesting because actually the capacity to generate heat through the thyroid system is really enhanced. Although at the tissue level, the enzymes that create the active thyroid hormone are decreased during the hibernation season. But still, the idea is the system in itself is there to generate heat if it's needed. And it is often because these animals, the ground squirrels, they get so cold that for some reason unknown, they need to rewarm every now and then. So on a kind of a regular rhythm, about every 2 to 3 weeks in the Arctic ground squirrel, they will rewarm up to their normal 37. And then within about a day, they go back down.
Hmm.
And we call those inner bout arousals.
Wow.
And it does all kinds of functional things. You know, for one, they might need to urinate a little bit.
Yeah.
The other is that it regrows their synapses in the brain because as they get cold, it can just dissipate. And then, you know, so all these synapses retract and now they need to regrow them. But what actually cues those inner bout arousals, we don't know. We think it's a metabolite that may be a waste product that accumulates.
Kelly, talk to us about human hibernation then. Is there something that bears and squirrels have in their DNA or in their physiology that we don't have?
No, they don't. There is nothing as far as we know. And particularly if you look at the distribution of the animals that hibernate, you can see that it's not a single lineage. And so it's expected that all animals have the genes to hibernate, but the expression of specific genes may be different. And so understanding how to do that is going to help. But the, you know, upstream or downstream, I guess, of the gene level, we understand some of the signaling molecules. And so again, kind of a hormone, not really, it's considered a neuromodulator, is a molecule called adenosine. And so it's really interesting that we see adenosine playing a role in normal natural hibernation in that it accumulates in the fall in the blood. And before animals hibernate, and it is each time they go down into this torpor, it dissipates, and then it accumulates again as they do the inner bout arousal, and that goes on. So we think that adenosine plays a really big role in the brain to lower the thermostat.
Right.
And adenosine is also the molecule that makes us sleepy.
Okay.
Yeah, and so it all beginning to fit together with adenosine, and I would expect that humans probably have a seasonal rhythm as well, where in the winter we have a little bit lower metabolism, we want to sleep more. That hasn't really been fully explored, but we can manipulate that adenosine system with drugs. So in the ground squirrel, we can induce hibernation with an adenosine, it's called an adenosine agonist, a drug, a small molecule that tickles the adenosine receptor. We're familiar with that receptor because caffeine blocks it. So when we're sleepy and we drink caffeine, we wake up because we're blocking adenosine receptors.
Right.
So this is the same system that makes animals sleepy in the wintertime.
So you could give this drug to a squirrel and even in summer induce hibernation?
So it's not as sensitive in summer. And so our studies haven't done the full dose response to see if a higher dose in summer would induce it. So at the same dose, they're much more sensitive in winter. And that's when we saw the drug-induced hibernation.
Okay.
And then we started using rats. And to make it work in rats consistently, we just upped the dose. And so now we can induce it in rats. And
don't hibernate ordinarily?
Right. Rats do not normally hibernate. Mice will go into torpor. Rats do not, and we've tried it in pigs as well, and it absolutely turns down the thermostat.
So why would we want to do that in human beings, realistically?
Well, the first application is for critical care, particularly what's called neurocritical care, to protect the brain when it's been injured. And one of the leading causes of brain injury and death is cardiac arrest. So lots of times it's reported as a heart attack, but it's a cardiac arrest where the heart completely stops. The blood flow to the brain stops, and people generally can only survive that for about 5 minutes. And so when people are resuscitated, they typically die ultimately from brain injury. But that brain injury can be protected, or can be decreased by cooling the body. So it's called therapeutic hypothermia, or now it's called targeted temperature management. And they cool the person between 32 to 36 degrees. It initially was 32 to 34. And now the clinical trials are showing that 36 might be as effective. It's still a huge matter of debate on the optimal temperature. But it's used clinically at standard of care. But it's not really optimal because they don't have a good way to control shivering. So it's been used in cardiac arrest a lot because those people are comatose. And it's a little easier to
cool them down, right? But if you can't operate on someone who, if they're shivering and cool, and you have to be pretty precise when you're operating on a brain.
Yeah, right.
Right. So and I think I've seen that. I've seen these cooling bags and people who've been injured being put into ice to slow everything down, blood flow and damage to brain tissue that comes from the atrophy from not getting air, right? But could we go further? Could we? I mean, actually, well, here's a question. Here's a question. Is a coma different to torpor? The hibernation and coma,
coma
are these different
is very
things?
Different. So a coma is is pathology due to injury. Everything's not working well. In hibernation,
but we can induce a coma.
We can induce a coma with drugs.
Is that then? How does that differ to hibernation?
Because those are just, you induce it with anesthetics, sedatives that just inhibit brain function.
Right.
And they don't target the thermostat. They have an influence on the thermostat, but not selectively and not specifically and not all that effectively. So these adenosine drugs really target that thermostat and turn it down. And if, so the difference is in hibernation is that you look due to cold that EEG gets flat. You think they were in a coma, but it's really a highly regulated physiologic functional state, not anything pathologic.
Right.
So that's the real difference. But we think that we will be able to induce hibernation for humans. And so we start with critical care. But the long-term vision is for space exploration. So we have worked with the NASA scientists, and we are actually submitting an application now to a NASA solicitation, or it's the Translational Research in Space Health solicitation. And I've also worked with the European Space Agency and have several colleagues in Europe that work a lot more closely with them. And so they are beginning to see that it is a possibility. And it's exciting because initially we need to figure out how to do it in short term, because we know in humans and even rats, the longer you keep a body cold, the more trouble occurs, more complications occur. So we need to learn it along the way.
Nice.
And I think we have the first step by being able to, you know, regulate this thermostat with these adenosine drugs and see how it works short term. You know, neurocritical care, the FDA is going to approve it because these people have such a high rate of death. And so if we can show that it's safe in these individuals, it's going to pave the way for further testing in healthy humans and extending the duration.
So what would that look like then in neuro care? Someone is in a car accident or has some sort of injury that could be fatal if we can't protect the brain. Is it an injection that modulates this hormone and then someone goes into a hibernation? Is that all you need?
Well, so you need some ice. You need something to, you know, some cold ambient temperature or something to extract heat from the body. But then this drug will slow down. It'll turn down the thermostat so they don't fight it. So it should be much easier than what they do now. Currently, there's a number of different ways of extracting heat from the body. The simplest is packing them in these in ice bags, or they have fancy devices like the Arctic Sun that is just a water cooled blanket that wraps around the body.
Right.
And so it would be going with those devices where you give a drug to stop the shivering.
How long do you think currently we might be able to hibernate a human for, knowing what we know now? And what other complications might arise by having a human hibernate? You were talking about urinating earlier. Like, are there problems if you hibernate a human for months?
Yeah, that's one of the things is the gut lining breaks down, and right. They can actually get septic from the gut. Ground squirrels and bears don't do that. So there's understanding the microbiome and how does that protect the gut during hibernation is a big area of interest. You know, also the heart isn't very happy in a rat if you keep them cold for a long time. And the longer they're cold, the more likely they'll have arrhythmias when they warm up for whatever reason, we don't know. But understanding more about how the heart is regulated, probably through the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, you know, it's all connected there. But these are the complications that come from long-term cooling. And so we just need to learn more about it.
At the moment, knowing what we know, what are you aiming for? A couple of hours, a couple of days?
Oh, so typically it's clinically it's 24 hours. Babies that are born without sufficient blood flow to the brain are cooled for 3 days now.
Wow.
And so that's the longest that is, used routinely in the clinic. But sometimes there's a debate on the severity of injury, severity of brain injury, maybe longer cooling is better. And until now, I don't think we really have the tools, but there are a number of different complications that arise with the humans when you cool them for long term. But we hope I've been working with a company called Spaceworks Enterprises here at the US, and they developed an entire torpor habitat for long-term space exploration. And they adopted really what we know about bears. And so what bears do is they don't just stay cold. First of all, they don't get as cold, so they don't have as many complications associated with that. And they sort of go back, wax and wane, not in a real regular way, between around 30 degrees all the way back up to 35, 36 degrees. And so this sort of wave-like period of cooling is probably what is going to be more tolerated by humans. And NASA likes that a lot because during the high points when people are fairly warm, it's easy to wake them up.
Yeah.
And they're needed in an emergency.
It sounds like such a sci-fi thing. It's crazy to think that the genes exist in our bodies to allow us to hibernate. Do you think that's something we'll see in our lifetimes, that we'll see hibernating humans traveling on spacecraft?
It all depends on how many resources are put into the research. So with the sufficient resources, absolutely. I it's exciting that the space agencies are getting interested.
Yeah.
And so we'll see. I think it's important that it has medical applications. It has applications for commercialization. Another big application is with this thing called postoperative shivering. So when people are anesthetized and come out of anesthesia, they often shiver a lot, very uncomfortably. And there's no drug at this point to stop that. And warm blankets sometimes work, but not always.
Right.
So that's another really large market where this kind of technology could be applied. And those, all those things together could potentially fuel enough resources into the research. But the most important thing, I think, is really looking at the animals, understanding how the animals do it, and try to emulate that. And as soon as we try to push past that and just force it to happen, then we run into trouble. So I really advocate understanding how the animals do it.
Yeah.
And then trying to replicate that.
We do hear stories of people surviving being in cold temperatures for, like, you know, sometimes 3 days. Is it possible that we used to hibernate and don't anymore? Could it be in our evolutionary heritage, this behavior?
It could be. And a lot of those examples are in cases of drowning, or one Japanese individual was, buried under snow, and which would have been a low oxygen condition. And again, that illustrates that with the right, under the right conditions, we can survive it. So it's just understanding that better. Yeah. But it's a, from the brain injury part, what's interesting, those who drown, it's expected that they cooled before their brain was significantly deprived of oxygen. But just the fact that they survived that long-term cooling and came out of it. And that's another area is bringing people, rewarming them is another area of intense research and advances. So that being able to rewarm an individual who has been very cold has really contributed to these people's survival. And part of that is that they take the heart offline when they're rewarming, so that they mechanically provide the heart function until the heart is warm enough, because it's the heart that really goes haywire when it rewarms.
Wow.
And so, yeah, so that's real critical care when people are very cold, but it shows how therapeutically benefiting it is to be very cold.
Yeah, well, we're used to that in Ireland for sure, being very cold. Everyone is swimming in the sea at the moment, and it is bitterly cold in there. So they're extending their life a little bit. It's been absolutely fascinating speaking with you, Professor Kelly Drew, Director of the Center of Transformative Research and Metabolism at the Institute of Arctic Biology in the University of Alaska. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. It's great to be here.
I know we went quite long on that one, but I just find that absolutely fascinating. The animal hibernation is one thing, and then the idea that theoretically we could hibernate humans for space travel, and that's not a crazy idea. I just love that. I'd love to hear your comments on it. You can email us science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. It's time to look back at some of your comments from last week's program. There were loads. Aidan McKelvey, producer, joins me to go through them. And we were talking about the moon and how new research has shown that the moon affects you and your sleep, even if you live in a city where you don't see the moon hardly ever. And this apparently was surprising. I was surprised that it was surprising. But someone takes it in saying the moon affects us because we are nocturnal hunters. Can you work this out? I mean, that's quite patronizing, isn't it, Aidan? But this is my theory, right? I want you to hear this. I've never heard this anywhere else before. I think it's got merit.
Exclusive.
I think we were crepuscular hunters. Crepuscular, of course, Aidan, as you know well, is dusk and dawn. And here's my theory. The theory is that we love sunsets and sunrises. We photograph them all the time. Photographers, you know, famously from Nat Geo are told, don't take a photograph if it wasn't taken at 6 a.m. in the morning or at 6 in the evening. There is something amazing about golden light that's diffused across the atmosphere. And I think this doesn't make any sense from an evolutionary point of view, because from an evolutionary point of view, surely we would want bright light shining down on the colors and potential prey. We'd want best visibility. But best visibility is not the most pleasant light to us. It's not pleasing. And I think the reason why we find that light so pleasing is some sort of evolutionary throwback to when we were crepuscular hunters.
Okay. I think you've made a little bit of a stretch. Like, it could be just that you like the colors of the sky, or the sunset or the sunrise connects you with the fact that you're on a planet.
But why? But why do we like it? Like, it doesn't, it's not the, come on, it doesn't, it's not because, I don't like a sunset because it connects with the fact that I'm on a planet. No, realistically, why do we find that light so pleasing? There's no reason for it. There's no, you know, why do we find it beautiful? I think we find it beautiful, and we universally find it beautiful. I think we find it beautiful because we were crepuscular, my friend.
But I mean, look, lots of people, you know, like looking
at
the night
sky. I sort of made it sound like, I know I made it sound like, oh, let's talk about this for a while like we do on other things. But actually, this is one of those things that I don't really want you to challenge this, because I think it's right. And I just, if you take it apart, I'll feel disappointed. I kind of feel like this is one of the things that I figured out by myself. This and junk DNA is not junk. That were the two things that I went, that doesn't sound right. And I was right about junk DNA.
Oh, yeah, you always
DNA.
Come back to that one.
I know. And this
You're
is another
right,
one.
Though,
so I don't want any challenges from anyone, particularly scientists who can really prove I'm wrong. I just want to think
Yeah, well,
right.
You haven't published a paper on it yet. And after all these years of your research, let's just wait till your paper's published.
Vincent says, ask any barman about crazy behavior of customers on nights with a new moon. Really, Vincent? Would love to hear those if you are a barman, bar lady, or if you a night staff at a...
I was a barman.
Were you?
Did
you link lunar cycles with customer behavior at all?
No, to be honest, absolutely not. I think people always tell me this, like full moons, people going crazy. And there's either one of two things going on here. It's sort of a self-fulfilling type of prophecy where people are aware of it and they look out for people who are crazy and then they equate that to what's going on. Or else I'm really, really inattentive to when it's a full moon and I just never notice.
But you do. You do know when it's a full moon. You just don't know it consciously, because that's what we found out last week, that even if you live in a city, you know when it's a full moon. Your body does, but you don't. Studies have shown that sleep cycles in space are relatively similar to Earth, so possibly the moon is not actually the driver in Earth sleep cycles, says one person. Well, obviously, you've got your circadian rhythm that's built into your behavior from birth. Your DNA could be written in some way. So I don't know. The moon could have had an effect for so long that it's now, you know, a hardwired thing. So I wouldn't discount that. We were talking about Mayan sacrifices as well. A really, really interesting piece that we did about sacrifice culture in Mayans and this amazing tomb. And Mary in Sandikov says, hello, Jonathan. Lovely to hear your report. We visited the cave of the stone sepulchre in 2001 when we lived in Belize. It was an unforgettable and spiritual experience. We recommend Pook's Hill, an eco lodge, to stay there. I did say it's a place to go before I die. Now I know where I'm going to stay as well. Thanks for that, Mary. Kit Chapman came on talking about super heavy elements. Loved that piece. Did you like it, Aidan? I just think he had so many great stories about this. But the photograph he tweeted on Twitter about Californium, he said he was in the presence of it. It was $30 million per gram, and he said this is all the Californium in the world, and it's like the top of a pin. That's how small it was.
Yeah, the photo was really cool. I was looking at it. I actually kind of was showing it to my girlfriend and going, this is really cool, isn't it? Tentatively, but she actually thought it was cool as well. So that's usually my measure, that I haven't gone too geeky science. It actually was a really cool photo.
Yeah, and it's green. Powell asked, why is it green, Powell? And Kit said the actinides can appear all sorts of colors. Actinides are the row of or column of elements that californium exists in. And he says plutonium goes from green to almost black. This is pure isotope CF249, californium 249. There's a conversation on Twitter that I kind of like to bring in. A guy called Dr. Gallagher says, was this spec made by humans? And if so, why? And Kit said, yes, it was. It was made by a lab here, and it's just never been done. That's why it was done. Some isotopes do have commercial uses, though. Really interesting subject, I think. And then finally, Aidan was telling me about his trip to the Yucatan Peninsula, and he was telling us about underwater caves, and he couldn't remember the name of them. And I was like, well, it must have been a great tour. You can't remember what it was, but they were called, what are they?
Cenotes. I made an absolute mess of trying to describe them. So thanks to Carol for actually somehow understanding what the hell I was talking about.
There's always someone who goes, oh, you mean this? And you go, yes, thank you. That's a great thing about radio, is there's always someone who sort of gets what you mean and can help you be more eloquent and find the right word. Garode says, when you were talking about the underwater caves at the end and couldn't think of what they were called, was Aidan talking about cenotes or some other geological feature? Cenotes are something I'd love to dive at some point. They look amazing. Well, if you look on our Twitter, you can see images of cenotes. But that's it from us for this week. Aidan, have you anything to add? That will actually improve the podcast.
No, I was just going to say, add that to your bucket list, Jonathan. You're going to go make that belief,
dive
in
some
cenotes,
travel south to go to the cave of the Crystal Maiden or whatever her name is.
We'll do it together on News Talks time.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, I can see that happening. that's it from us for this week's Future Proof. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Thanks to the team, who are Aidan McKelvey, Simon King, Garrett Mahal, Steve McClune, and Stephen Daunt. We'll be back with more Future Proof in the podcast extra on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.